Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in. Hello, hello, everyone. You are listening to the Rise Real Estate Investing Podcast with your host, Austin, and
Mayu. Hello, everybody.
How's everything going, Mayu? I see that you're stressed out today. You guys can't see, but Mayu is visually stressed because today's been a pretty hectic day for him. Why don't you vent it out in this podcast? What's been going on,
Mayu? Are we talking about, I guess
you know what we're talking about.
Yeah, okay. So we've got a fourplex that we bought off market. So it's a great purchase price. We bought it for $300K, significantly under market value, piece of shit property. Like, it needs a lot of fucking work. Now, that being said, like, the tenant quality that we inherited from the previous landlord was not the best. It was basically being run as a boarding house. We served our N11s and 13s as needed to get the property vacant for the amount of work that we have to do. And of course, once we served the N11s, we had one unit that was already vacant. The probably annoyed and upset tenants have now brought in some friends to be squatters in the upstairs unit. So that's great. We've already removed them twice. Today, for the third time, our property manager went and he was greeted by a guest that had a knife in his hand. So obviously the property manager kind of backed off, called the cops. So now we've got them detained and hopefully that's the last we'll be hearing of them, but I highly doubt it. So headed up to Windsor this Saturday, going to get some cameras installed, try to up our game on that side. And, you know, once we get the entire building vacant and we just start demoing it, like, I think people would be crazy to try and sleep in all that dust. So hopefully that helps as well. But yeah, man, Austin, what's going on with you?
Yeah, I mean, your problem's my problem. So we're going through the same situation right now. Aside from that, I know last time we were talking a little bit about that student rental where the investor got essentially a letter from the city saying you are not allowed to do work because it needs permits, right? So just an update on that end. With that letter, essentially, the inspector just popped up one day to the site, right? Randomly popped up to the site that we're working on and started looking through it. The contractor took him around and the inspector basically concluded, the city inspector, by the way, he basically concluded no permits are needed for any of the work that we did. Dun, dun, dun. Something we already knew, right? But it's just a scary feeling. Even though you know with certainty you don't need a permit, it's like, damn, what if the city just, for whatever reason, is just not in a good mood today and says, you need a permit for this entire house. It shouldn't even be here. And we got to demo everything.
Yeah, it kind of sucks how dependent you are on this random guy feeling some good mood today and to allow you to, you know, move forward with your project, right? Because permits are fine. Nothing, like, nothing wrong with them about the fees.
No, you need permits, yeah.
Forget all that stuff. It is what it is. But the delays that a permit could have on your project is what really bites you in the ass. The holding costs when you add like 1 or 2 months and like the, you know, like if you pay like hard money, like 12% and stuff like that, just completely cuts into your margin, right? I mean, the other thing that we did.
Now you're at the mercy of the inspector. So if the inspector catches anything else and says, oh, you need a permit for this. Oh, you actually did this wrong. You actually did that wrong. Now like everything is up for grabs. They can tell you to fix anything and everything. So it's not ideal. It's just why we like to stick to mainly cosmetic renovations, right? But with the fourplex that we're talking about, that is definitely going to need permits because there's a lot of work that needs to be done on that end. But luckily we figured everything out.
It's kind of crazy how much happens in a week, Austin. I think we both forgot about Machette. So Machette was a property that we bought off market. That one, when you talk about off markets, is the story behind every acquisition. So this one, we reached out to people that had properties up for rent, just offering to buy them. This one worked out. In this case, the seller had already moved to BC and she was trying to rent out her place. So instead, we stepped in, got a quick closing done a couple weeks, I think, by the end of it. So we closed on it, listed it the next week. And now we've sold it and we're walking out with what, like mid like mid five figures in profit. So that's, you know, going to go straight to our corporation, fund the next buy and the next burr. So we'll keep going from there.
I think we covered most of the things. We've always up to a lot. A lot can happen in a week. It's just, I think we also have been staying out part. Our energy is that we're always trying to look for deals. We're always trying to look for the next thing. And it could be to our detriment because, I mean, we told ourselves we're not going to look for deals anymore. And we're not really, but we are kind of. I don't know how to explain it. We're keeping an eye on the market, right, to see what's out there.
We're trying to take a two-week break. Maybe after like this week,
two or 3 week break. That'd be nice for sure. I get our project wrapped up, but anyway, we're going to be getting into this podcast today, and it's with Nish of All Trades, Nish B. He has a YouTube channel. He's an Instagram, social media influencer. He's big into personal finance. In this podcast, you're going to hear all about, us talking about his portfolio comprised of real estate investments, him house hacking, how he's able to keep his budget down, his not only his real estate portfolio, but his stock portfolio as well, and his kind of philosophies on how he goes about life and his ideas of financial independence, retire early. So this is a really interesting podcast, guys. You don't want to miss this. Make sure to tune in.
All right, everyone. So today we have Nish. Nish, I could give a quick bio on you, but why don't you just go ahead and tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Nish. I live in Ontario here. I'm a real estate investor. I'm deeply interested in personal finance related topics. My day job, I work in the currency department at Bank of Canada. Nothing related to economics or interest rates. I know nothing about that stuff, so don't ask me. In terms of like where rates are going and all that sort of thing. If you want to talk about banknotes, I'm your guy. But what else? My background, I've got a BBA, an MBA. Did my MBA at Wilfrid Laurier, did my BBA at Guelph Humber. What else? I've got my CMA, CPA designation. So I've got somewhat of an accounting background, but I've never really used it in the professional world, really. What else? Yeah, I own four properties right now, including my primary residence. I've sold two this year. So I had six at some point that I'm down to four now.
Wow, you're offloading now, eh?
Yeah, offloading a little bit, yes. Getting some cash ready. Or actually paying down some debt. Really just paying down some debt going to start another house hacking thing that I'm trying to do so we can reduce our shelter costs.
So since you went into that, what is house hacking? I mean, me and Austin, we both know it, but for everyone else, what is house hacking? What are you doing and what does that look like financially?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So house hacking is the idea where you try to offset your living costs, your shelter costs, which is shelter is, you know, the place you live, whether it's you're renting or you're owning the place, and you try to reduce that cost by renting a portion of that space out, and that reduces your overall cost. So for example, in a small house that we were living in before, we rented out the second floor unit. It was a one bedroom, and we were living in this two bedroom unit for 1 year. And we were renting that out for $1,100. The whole house cost about $1,800 to run. So it cost us $700 a month to live in that space for a family of four. You know, that's less than a res student, you know, sometimes. So that's pretty good. We were doing that for a while. And we realized that, you know, living in a 650 square foot space as a family, growing family of four, we're like, nah, don't want to do that. So we've moved more recently into a bigger space with a basement apartment that's got two bedrooms that we're going to be renting out. And we're fixing it up right now and then rent out. And that's going to offset the cost because shelter costs typically are your largest life expense in general for most people. And so we figure if we can tackle that big item, that, you know, that really will help us also live our life the way we kind of want, because I read this book called Early Retirement Extreme, really good book. And the author, Jacob Lundfisker, really brought, He kind of emphasize the point that it's such a weird society we live in today where we outsource everything, whether it is our, you know, if we need a plumbing, you know, if we had some plumbing issue, we got to outsource it to the plumber. If you got some electrical issue, we typically have to outsource the electrician. Any kind of repair, you're going to outsource it. And we even outsource our child rearing now. That's what we've come to. And he's like, what? That's just weird. We've outsourced our child rearing. We outsource it to daycare. Like, if you want to survive these days, typically you're going to have both the spouse and yourself, both people working full time to survive in general. And so he says, this is such a weird concept. Like, this is really new when you think about it, historically speaking, for mankind, where, you know, we're outsourcing our child rearing. And so I was like, oh, it's a really good point. Like, that's a really good point. Like, it is bizarre when, yeah, I've outsourced my child rearing.
That's a very deep direction.
Yeah, it's a good book. Matt McKeever and Mike Rosehart, those guys brought up that book back in their YouTube video. So I really like it. And so I was like, okay, he's got a good point. I don't want to outsource my child rearing. How do I make this happen? And then, and so the house hacking aspect became even more important. So we sold our place in Brampton just over a year ago. And then we moved to a place in Guelph, a rental actually we owned in Guelph, and fixed that up as well and lived in it. And then house hacked that space was too small. Now we moved to another space to house hack and still continue to not outsource our child rearing. And
you're doing all this in Guelph?
In Guelph, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So actually, yeah, I was interested because I was wondering, I thought you were in Toronto or somewhere around the GTA region. So house hacking there is fairly difficult, right? I mean, it's possible, but definitely offsetting your entire expense would be a bit harder in the GTA. So you mentioned that you are house hacking one of your rental properties. So was that like a duplex? Are you Airbnb-ing a couple of bedrooms? How are you going about that?
So that was already it's like a duplex. Yeah. It's got a house with an accessory unit. And so we rented out that separate unit. It's completely separate, a separate washroom, but it was in a pretty in demand area. We had purchased that place back in 2016 for like 300K. And, we've probably put about 70K into it, to fix it up. And it's just an in demand area. It was, so very easy to rent. We're getting like $1,100 for this, like one bedroom unit that was probably 450 square feet. And so
that's
yeah, it's great. And like, it was like 2018 was a great time to rent to people. I mean, I guess this, 2018 was great. Like, cause like I was shocked cause the people that were living, the girl that was living there before, she was paying $850 a month in rent. And then 2018 she left. And then, so gave us last minute notice too. So I was like, whatever, posted it. And I was shocked by the amount of people that ended up coming to the open house back when open houses were a thing, or like a more of a thing. And, 80 plus messages on Kijiji and 30 plus people showed up and they're all people with decent jobs like teachers and electricians and things. So in demand areas, something to say for picking a house in a good spot, like good area.
Absolutely. No, for sure. So actually, why don't you get into some detail on, I'm not sure if your wife and was on board with it, having kids and all of that, but I've been trying to convince my girlfriend to house hack, right? yes. The big thing with house hacking is that, or at least in my head, is since I want to offset as much cost, I'm going to be staying in, I guess, quote unquote, less desirable cities. So not really within core downtown or Toronto or anything like that. She's not very open with the idea, maybe partially because I told her we'll stay in the basement and we'll rent the upstairs. So I guess that's one of the things. But how was that conversation like? How was it house hacking with a family?
I presented the idea, you know, and I was a hard no at first, for sure. It was a hard no at first. My wife was pregnant with our second daughter as well. And she really was not enjoying her job. She was finding like she's an early childhood educator, and she was partnered with, like, sometimes it's really hit or miss with the teachers that you get partnered with. And she got partnered with somebody that should not be near children. She was pregnant too. And she's just like, you know, like, I've had it. Like, what do I do? And also I kind of sold it to her in a way where as well, like, or kind of, you know, highlighted the benefits. We'd save more. She wouldn't have to work necessarily a job she doesn't necessarily like. And also we could travel more, save more money means more travel money. So I guess emphasizing the benefits that your spouse would appreciate from doing house hacking would be a big, big way to get them to do it. Cause also downsizing, cause we went from an 1800 square foot house to like 650 square foot. And so how we managed that was that we both watched that documentary on minimalism. It was on Netflix. It was called Minimalism.
Yeah. Oh man, that's okay. I know exactly what you're talking about. That's so hectic. I tried it for like 3 days.
That was extreme.
Yeah, just start, those guys are extreme, man. They lived in one suitcase. The guy separated his dirty underwear with the clean underwear with like a red underwear in the middle. That's how he knows which side has like the dirty underwear, the clean underwear. I was like, that's extreme. Okay, we didn't do that. I think we were kind of inspired by that whole idea of reducing your overall footprint.
I think a lot of people, even if you look at like Toronto and the GTA, renting out your basement is essentially just house hacking, right? Like people have been doing it for generations, and it used to be a lot cleaner, right? Like it used to be like, oh, you buy a house for like 250K, 300, whatever, 400, and you can rent out the basement for like 800 bucks. That basically covers your mortgage. So now, now a lot of, I guess you're more out of pocket. And I think the difference between if you look at Guelph versus like Scarborough, for example, you're probably in Guelph, if you're out of pocket, like 600, 700 in Scarborough, you're probably out of pocket, like 1,000, 1,200, but it's still not a bad way to live in the city for like 1,200 bucks. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's one of the, like, it's pretty significantly undervalued as a way of, you know, saving a lot of money. And Nish, I know you've got like your YouTube channel. And so what else are you up to? Like aside from house hacking, how else are you making money, and what other streams of income do you have going for you right now?
With my investment properties, I've bought in areas that don't really cash flow very well, like Guelph, Kitchener, and Hamilton. So I own a rental in Kitchener with my friend, a duplex conversion project that we did in Hamilton with my brother and sister-in-law, single family in Guelph, and then just my primary residence. So in terms of cash flowing properties, you guys would be the ones to talk to, because I have not succeeded with like cash flowing properties here in the surrounding GTA area. But I did buy fairly, I got lucky. I guess, I bought a couple of properties pretty early on, like 2015, 2016, 2017. They did really well just from appreciation. They did really well. Even, and that tiny house that we were living in, the small house, we ended up selling it. And so that's done. So there's real estate investment. In terms of other source of cash flow, once I get this basement ready, hopefully that gets us a good, it hopefully rents out for $1,450 a month. So we'll get that. And then dividend paying stocks. I have some RioCan stocks. So I'm looking into setting up the mortgage on this house, having a home equity line of credit on it. And I'm planning to use the home equity line of credit to probably buy more dividend paying stocks in the near term. And so just like dividend paying companies, like just solid companies like banks, some banks that pay a dividend higher than what the interest expense will be, and just making money on the difference.
There's a name for that strategy, right? Where you, I think you had a YouTube video on this, if I'm not mistaken, where you essentially pay down your mortgage, then you take out the money in the HELOC and you buy the stocks, and then you like.
Is that like kind of like the Smith maneuver? It's not the Smith maneuver, yeah, right? That's right. Another property with it, if I'm not mistaken. But so I'm assuming when you're buying dividend paying stocks, it's likely going to be like bank stocks, right? I think the yield is 5%. What's the HELOC? Probably like 2.45%. Is it prime? Maybe prime.
2.45 would be pretty good. I think 2.95 right now would be more normal. If you're getting 2.45, that's really good. 2.95.
Yeah, well, I work at RBC, so I get a bit of benefits, right? So it looks like you're taking 2.5 to 3% return. Over the long term, though, so it's completely passive. And also you get that passive appreciation with bank stocks, because generally they're definitely more stable than a lot of the other companies that are out there. Have you ever considered, I guess it's out of my own curiosity, just like, I mean, if you're looking at 2.53%, like, I don't know what a government bonds right now or corporate bonds, things of that nature, because I think the returns are probably somewhat similar, I'd imagine.
I haven't really looked at the bond market very much. I haven't really played in the bond market field.
What about private lending? Like, why not just take it out from the HELOC and go the private lending route, right? You pocket 12%, net interest rate is about like 9. I know I did that like early on, just because like I had money in my HELOC, didn't really know what to do with it. So someone approached me for a loan. But do you ever think about going that route or no?
Yeah, I haven't actually dabbled in private lending yet. I do want to try it out just as long as I can be, you know, at least at a minimum second on the mortgage on a property to make sure that it's not just like a promissory note that I have. It's just, it's something where it's backed against a property. That's the only way I would really want to try it out personally, but you can structure it through your TFSA and RRSP as well, which would be pretty sweet.
Yeah. I mean, as long as you're facilitating with the investor directly or with like a broker that essentially brings your product to you. And I think as long as you understand the real estate class and you can kind of mitigate your risks on that side, like private lending is always a pretty solid, like passive, like truly passive investment strategy, right? All you do is you analyze that property, make sure the value that the broker and the appraiser is telling you is accurate. If it's accurate, then, you know, as long as you're comfortable with the loan to value that you're lending on, like it's generally a pretty solid like rate of return. So I don't know, that's something you should look into, man. Like, especially now, like I didn't know about the RRSP TFSA hack until maybe like a few months ago, but like knowing that, it's crazy. Like essentially the strategy that I can't remember where I saw it. But if you got like, let's just say 50K in your RRSP and another like 30K in your TFSA, you can issue that private loan at 80K just from those funds. And then what you can do is you can set it up so your RRSP gets your rate of return of like 4%, right? Like something negligible. And then the overall portfolio for the at 80K would get you 12%. So then you say, okay, so now my TFSA at 30K that I'm putting in, make that 18 or 19%. Right. Mm-hmm. The result is all the interest is being funneled to your TFSA, which is tax free and never really going to be taxed. Yeah. Right. Versus your RSP will eventually be taxed. So I don't know. I think that's a cool hack. And now that I know about it, I've been telling everyone that I can possibly tell to look into it, especially like my parents that like they want nothing to do with real estate and they're happy with their principal residence. So I'm like, okay, like why don't you just do this? It's not like you're making crazy money on your index funds and whatever.
That's true. So I like it. I like it. I'd like to experiment in that and maybe even document it for YouTube as well, because that'd be neat. I like dividend companies, you know, investing in dividend stocks for now as well. I like analyzing financial statements. Why not take a look at that? Use that account, that dusty accounting destination, you know, once in a while, I guess.
Guys, we're not all about just real estate. We're about diversifying.
Yes, gotta diversify that.
My wife's been telling me I've got to move 10% of my net worth into stocks, because up until this year I have had like $0 in stocks. I tried back in 2015, and I'm way too emotional of an investor. So like I'd buy the stock, and then things are going down. Like today, I know they've been all over the place, and then I'd be like, oh fuck this, I'm out. Like let me just sell, right? And then my stock portfolio was just like never increasing, minus the fact that I kept putting money into it, right? So after that, I was like, you know what, I'm done with this stuff. But now I think we need some diversification, especially like if you look at everything that's happening in the market right now, like you have no idea where things are going to go. And I think what's interesting is real estate is honestly a very debt fueled, like it's a debt pumped up ecosystem, right? Like if you take away the debt, like real estate is just going to collapse, right? Versus if you look at stocks, there is value in the actual stock. It's not pumped up by false debt and like the government essentially providing easy access to funds, right? So I don't know. I've been looking more deeper into it, but I'm still not making money on stocks.
One thing I've been thinking about a lot lately, because I guess I've been watching YouTube content and looking at guys like Ray Dalio and Peter Schiff and Robert Kiyosaki, and they're all kind of talking, George Gammon, they're talking about like what the U.S. Federal Reserve is doing with their expansionary monetary policy, where they're like printing more money in effect. And then, I guess to keep it simple, like they're saying like the value of that of U.S. dollars is going to lose it. It's going to lose its value, and it's going to become a big problem. That's what these guys are saying. And they're saying,
hold real hard assets, I'm assuming, right? Things that have intrinsic value.
Yes. So they're saying, yeah, hold real assets like gold and silver. They're saying gold and silver a lot. And so, yeah, it's something I'm thinking about a little bit too, you know, maybe holding a little bit more silver and gold.
I think the more of an investor you become, I think the more of an investor that everyone becomes, the more of like, it's almost like you're becoming a conspiracy theorist. Cause I know exactly what you're talking about. I've been watching those like videos on like the debt field economy, watching like reading up on like the potential fall of the US currency, and like what that could do to the global world order and like the valuation and all this stuff. And it's just like, fuck, this is too much. Like, this is,
yeah, I mean, you know, we're living in kind of a weird time right now. I think Apple, their value, they were the first, what, $1 trillion company market cap, and what, they doubled that in what, 6 months or something along those lines? In less than a year, they doubled their market cap, right? That you cannot, a company cannot add $1 trillion in value. An intrinsic value in less than a year, right? So it's kind of, we're definitely spinning our wheels. Anything could happen. So I mean, it is important to diversify. I like my ears and your wife said, hold 10% of your net worth in equities or at least some sort of other investment. I totally agree with that as well. I'm siding with your wife. but I am personally not doing that, which I should. But anyways, kind of, I know we kind of got sidetracked with taxes and all of that. But kind of just to move everything back to real estate a bit. Nish, so you mentioned that you had 6 properties sold to us, so now you're down to 4. Why don't you give the listeners a bit of an insight as to how you got into real estate, purchased your first property and moved forward and scaled up to 6?
Sure. So I don't want to sound super cliche, but when I was in high school back in, I was a grocery clerk at the old grocery store called Price Chopper. And, at the end of the night,
open anymore?
They're called Freshco now. They're called Freshco. You know, Freshco. Yeah. They did a rebrand. So now they're Freshco. Their colors are like black and yellow, I think, or green, light green, as opposed to orange and blue for Price Chopper. Anyway, I was a grocery clerk back then, and at the end of the night, we would bring all the products to the front of the shelf, and you do that for the whole store. And so at the end of the night, my coworker, he was telling me about the story of Rich Dad Poor Dad, and I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And working a shitty job, I'm just like, yeah, that sounds amazing. I didn't even read the book till like more recently, like maybe 2 years ago. I didn't read the book until like 2 years ago, but the actual story was powerful enough to like stick with me for a very long time. And I was thinking, yeah, I would like to do that one day. And when I was in first year university, so I guess that was like 2006, there was also some kind of fly by night programs that you see on the TV for like real estate investing. And one of these guys called Russ Whitney. I don't know if you guys remember that name. It was like on TV, American guy. Yeah. Anyways, we went to that weekend course and we spent like $3,000 or $4,000, me and my dad at the time there. And we went to the course, and then we were even looking at it in 2006, and part of that course, we actually walked through downtown Hamilton in 2006. And I kid you not, the properties, the listings were like 40,000. 30,000, 50,000 for these houses that were 3-plex, 4-plex, 5-plex, 6-plex. But you know, we went through that course, my dad and I, and then we never ended up pulling the trigger on anything because, well, I just kind of kept making excuses, mainly because we didn't really have YouTube back then either. And so I didn't know anybody else who was doing this. And I was just too chicken to do it. So we never actually bought anything in Hamilton, but imagine 2006, that would have been nuts. So anyways, I didn't do anything. I just went to school, did my undergraduate degree, quickly did a co-op MBA program at Laurier, got a good job. And then once I started making money, started paying down my student debts, I'm like, okay, now I should probably think about doing something. My wife and I, we got married, we bought our first place in Brampton. And, after that, when we started accumulating some funds, we're like, okay, now maybe we should buy some real estate. And we always liked Guelph the few times we did visit it. And we thought, okay, maybe Guelph might be a good place. So I got my uncle to look at a few properties, and we picked this property that was in closer to downtown Guelph area. And it was sitting on the market for like 70 days back in 2015. like 70 days or like 80 days. And it was like for $250. It was a fixer upper, like a toilet. There was like this broken toilet with poop in it, like in one of the pictures. it was like really bad.
Probably why it was sitting on 70 days.
Yeah, the agent couldn't even close the damn lid, eh?
He couldn't close the lid. Yeah, so we picked it up. It was sitting there for $250 at the time. And so we picked that up, and I got my two cousins to help me out for about a month. We'd go every day after work. They weren't working at the time, they were students as well. And so every day after work, we'd go and we'd fix it up with my wife and I, and the four of us in total. We just, like, it's just cosmetic repairs. Looking back, it's just painting, flooring, fixing up some cabinets, replacing a toilet, then flushing the girls' nest. Yeah, maybe removing some cast iron pipe. But we got a plumber for that. Yeah, little stuff like that. We did that in a month, rented it out, and that was that for that summer in 2015. And then 2016, at this time I was about four or five years into my, like, really full-time career. And there was this interview that I was looking for a career change, and I thought, okay, I need to move up. I need to get a higher paying job, right? So that's what I was telling myself. I need to get a higher paying job. And then I applied for this job in downtown Toronto, and I had the worst time getting to this interview. Like, it was just a terrible day. I think there was like a fire or something on the gardener. And then what happened was that I was an hour late for that interview, and I still got the job offer. I still got the job offer being an hour late for this interview, which was nuts. And then I'm like, is the universe trying to tell me?
That's some pursuit of happiness.
It was like pursuit of happiness.
Nish just ripped the story off of that.
I swear I did. It was like pursuit of happiness. But yeah, and then I'm like, all this for this job that, you know, pays about the same, but there's a lot more opportunity to grow in the career because of the role. There's more opportunity for growth. And I thought to myself, okay, I could do this, and yeah, eventually I'll climb up the ladder and, you know, make, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30K more over the next couple of years. Or do I just buy another house and just work on that this summer? And then I ended up telling the person, like, I, you know, the hiring manager, I was just like, sorry, I appreciate the offer and all that. And I didn't take the job. Even after showing up an hour late, and I ended up buying a second property. That property, that tiny home that we lived in this past year, I ended up buying that house, fixing it up, and then renting it out. And you know, looking back at it 4 years after the fact, we've just sold the property, and it was the right decision. Money wise, it was definitely the right decision, because we definitely made more than I would have made probably in my career progression that way. So I did that. And then I ended up buying another property that in 2016 in November with my friend in Kitchener. And that property in Kitchener had some issues. The inspection guy that I was using, that I've used for the past like three properties before that, he didn't find that there was knob and tube throughout the entire house. He just said it's only in the attic. I was like, okay, well, that's manageable. We find out it's actually throughout the entire house. And that seemed like the end of the world.
Didn't interrupt you. Quick tip for people: if there's knob and tube visible in one area of the house, very likely they didn't replace it behind the walls. How do I know? Because that, I mean, Mai, you can attest, that's pretty much every house in Windsor.
Yeah.
Every house in Windsor.
To the point where, like, everywhere. Yeah, it's just fucking everywhere. Like, and like, it's like, you know, like somewhere between 5 to 10K to rip out and replace, but. It's kind of the effort of like ripping up all this drywall and pulling it all out and putting back new wires, and it's just a headache. But I mean, if the numbers work, they work, right?
Yeah, as long as you're accounting for it. As long as you're accounting for it, yeah, for that.
That's true. Which,
yeah, I did not. And anyways,
just so everyone knows what knob and tube is, I feel like we just talked about it for like a solid minute. We never actually explained it. It's essentially this super old wiring. Austin, do you know when
it? It was like, I think it was early 1900s. Very common in a lot of older houses. Knob and tube is not grounded, and it's known to cause a lot of fires because of the fact it's not grounded as being one of them. A lot of insurance companies will not insure knob and tube. Mm-hmm. And pretty much if you buy a house with knob and tube in the tenant's best interest, your best interest, peace of mind, you should probably end up replacing it to copper. It's the ESA still allows for knob and tube if it's kept safe and up to date. But I mean, again, it's a huge fire hazard, which should say something if insurance companies are not willing to insure it.
Yeah. So insurance is a pain in the ass. Usually it's a good avenue to knock like $5,000 to $10,000 off the purchase price, whatever you negotiated, as long as you find it before you guys firm up. But for the most part, like it's manageable, right? Like you can fix it, and it sounds like that's what you did, Nish. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Assuming it's, well, this place had plaster for most of the house still as well. So it was going to be much more than $5,000 or $10,000 actually. Oh, yeah. but we ended up actually, so you can, like Austin said, you can bring up knob and tube up to code if you add these, GFCI receptacle thingies. So, you know, those, so your power outlet, there's like the red button that says the reset button. You gotta have those on there. And there's something you have to do at the actual, what's it called? The electrical box. You gotta do a few things there, and there's some other things you gotta do to bring it up to code. And so we did that, and did that for like just under $6,000, and brought up to code. Insurance company's cool with that, and we left it at that. So hopefully, knock on wood, it's not wood, but it's hopefully it's all good. Yeah, it's up to code. Okay, it's up to code. They said it's up to code. So we'll see how that goes. That should be good. So we've had that for like 4 years now, and that's worked out. That's worked out. Just holding it, it's worked out okay as well for my partner and myself. And so that was our fourth property, including our primary residence. And then we waited, we had our daughter in 2017. We waited until 2018 to jump on a joint venture with my brother and sister-in-law in Hamilton. And we did a duplex conversion there. And we had a contractor that came. They ended up screwing us because they're kind of like, they took a big deposit. They're kind of dragging their feet. They didn't do all the work, and we ended up having to fire them, getting a more reputable contractor to finish the duplex conversion. It's been good so far. We're actually trying to look for a renter for the basement because the basement folks have left there. And so we did that in 2018. We did also purchase a property in Windsor, and that was also with a partner. Didn't go well with the partner. I'll probably leave it at that. Just it didn't go well, and we're actually just selling that property and cashing out of there, and then pay down some line of credit debt for that as well. So then I've sold the actual small house that we were living in Guelph just a couple of months ago. Did that myself. First time I've actually sold a property myself. And there's this listing service called
like Purple Bricks. Like you listed it yourself on like a for sale by owner type.
No, not even Purple Bricks. It's called I think the service is called Listed by Seller. And it's like $60 a month.
Basic as the name gets.
Yeah, Listed by Seller. $60 a month. You can list your house on realtor.ca. It's $60 a month. You do put all your pictures and everything else. And as long as you know your market, the price it's going for, you deal with the agents. And I tried that out for the first time. I haven't done it. It worked out well. Like the buyer with somebody with an agent as well. And then the agent provided the offer documentation, and I just looked it over, made sure it was all good.
You listed your property on realtor.ca through that service?
Through that service, yeah.
Wow.
It's $60 a month, man. I was like, what?
Dude, that's
crazy.
Yeah. It only took me a month too. So I was like, $60.
In a market like this, that definitely.
And you got top dollar from that? Like you were able to get like good interest, like
overall for, I got, still got good interest. A lot of people came by to look at it. This was in May. So I listed it, beginning of May. There were some kind of like, I guess it's still the same restrictions as now. People wear masks and gloves. No real, can you do open houses right now? Like, I don't even know, but back over in May, you could not do that stuff at all. Okay. So now too.
Yeah, so, but May was a tough time to sell. So like, if you sold in May, like you must have done, I mean, pretty decent. And if you're happy with your price, like shit, that's pretty good, yeah, man.
Well, we sold it for $546. I listed it for $565, and we sold it for $546. So we were okay with that. $546 for this is a 2-bedroom plus 1-bedroom. Like the whole house in total was like 1,050 square feet.
Yeah.
in a decent area in Guelph, but 2 + 1 for 546 in.
So was all of this capital you're accumulating kind of from the sales, what are you hoping to redeploy that into real estate again, or is that kind of where the dividends are coming in? Because you also mentioned you have a HELOC available. What's the game plan? Because I mean, us as investors, we know that cash is king, definitely, but there's also the other half, cash is trash, right? It's not earning us anything, it's losing money to
Oh, Ray Dalio quote, nice, cash is trash. I like it. I'm planning to probably pay down some. I had some mortgage debt on another property. I put a second mortgage on what that first property we bought in 2015 to finance our Windsor project. So I can either, I don't really need to pay it down because it kind of covers itself. So I will probably take those funds, pay down this primary residence mortgage a little bit more, and then boost the home equity line of credit. So there's more to do. And then, yeah, so it's really a question mark for me. I'm still debating. I'm like, dividends, dividend paying stocks, eligible dividend. Those are nice. Canadian eligible dividends are nice. Private lending, dabble in private lending. That's on my to-do. And then more real estate investment. With real estate investment, like, I feel like I had the most success when I was more actively involved in the projects. That's just from my experience so far. Like the most success, the most money I've made was by myself managing everything. That, so if I am going to do something like that, problem is like I can't run to a house after work now to go fix up a property all night to like midnight because I got two kids at home. So I've tried bringing the kids, but that works out some because that Hamilton property, when the contractor screwed us over, we ended up doing a lot more of the work in the middle of winter. We brought our two like kids under one and a half and under one to go paint a house because we needed to get that done. But it's not fun. It is not fun.
So I've been meaning to ask as well. So I guess you acquired quite a bit of properties throughout that entire process. You're basically buying what seems like a property a year. And it's not easy to save that amount of money to pay for down payments and renovations. So how are you funding these projects? Which is some of it through saving, some of it through lines of credits, HELOCs. How are you going about financing every property that you had?
So savings at first, savings at first to buy that first property, as well as a line of credit on our primary residence to have the down payment for the property. And then we were actually able to put a home equity line of credit on our rental property. So with Scotia, for example, that's where we've had some success with putting a home equity line of credit on a rental property. And so we use that to finance the next property as well. So we kind of just kept doing that. One thing to note though, is that once my wife, stopped working, it does greatly diminish our, it reduces how much money you can qualify for overall. And so that's one thing to note that has impacted us over time, slowed us down. But having that home equity line of credit and then using that to finance the next property, fixing up the property, and then putting, if you can put a home equity line of credit or a second mortgage on that to finance the next property is what you could do. They call that the BRRRR, I suppose. But I didn't really BRRRR right away, to be honest. I really forgot the last part of the R, or not really, didn't really take advantage of that last part of the R, or the second last, the refinance component. Like even on that first place we bought in Guelph for the second place, we didn't do that immediately after. We kind of, I was watching Matt McKeever's videos back starting in early 2018, and he kept talking about the BRRRR, and I was like, oh yeah, I should probably do that. and then that's, a year and a half or 2 years later, that's when I did the last part of that R, where you refinance, take that money and go invest in something else. So that really helps accelerating things, because to save up more money to go then put to buy another property would take you forever.
No, absolutely. I definitely agree. Refinancing is very important. And it's hard to save for enough money, but it is possible. And it is the reality for a lot of newer investors, because of course they don't have their primary residence just yet. So they don't have a they can't take advantage of that HELOC. So they might be able to do, I guess, more complex strategies, vendor takebacks. I'm not going to go into that right now. Private financing, but they still need to somewhat come up with at least a bit of capital. And I've been watching a bit of your YouTube videos, Nish, and I noticed that you're a huge junkie when it comes to personal finance. I am too. I believe in frugality, unlike Mayu. So Nish, why don't we talk a little bit about how frugality has helped you along with the entire investing journey so far?
Sure. Frugality has really been a key way for us to save more money, and just having that mindset to, whenever you're thinking about buying something, to think about what are the alternatives to buying that thing. I got my first car mainly because I needed it for my job, but I was really looking at taking the bus. And I tried that for the first 3 weeks, and it took 3 buses to get, and 2.5 hours to get to this office in Mississauga from Brampton. Like, it was just like, it shouldn't take that long. If you missed one bus, you're screwed. So I decided to splurge and get a used 2006 Camry, had 100,000 kilometers on it. I did my research on a vehicle. A vehicle is like one of your biggest purchases aside from your house. And so I spent a lot of time, looked at what the common problem was with every model of Toyota Camrys from like 2002 to 2009. I ended up not going for the 2009. I could have done it, but 2009, anything 2007, 8 and 9 had a lot of problems and recall. So I ended up going 2006, and you know, a lot of reviews of people driving it to like 500,000 kilometers, no problem. And, got that used 2006 Camry. It was $11,000 at the time. And I still drive that car to this day. Like, it had 100,000 kilometers. Now it's got 330,000 kilometers. I guess how many years later? 2011, 9 years later.
That definitely sounds like a foreign lifestyle to a lot of people. Were you always frugal, or was there like a shift in mindset? Because I can tell you firsthand, like, I started off a bit frugal, and then going into university, I mean, there was still a sense of frugality, but I spent money on a lot of stupid shit. Like, I had $1,000 nights, $1,000 weekends. I've purchased my fair share of luxury items, which are things I don't use anymore. But like, was there a transition? Cause that's not a common mindset to have, to save money.
Yeah. I was kind of like, I was not well off growing up as a kid, and I guess being exposed to my parents' financial concerns and issues at an early age helped, and in shaping kind of like my views with frugality and just trying to be more conservative with spending. That helped a lot, just being exposed at an early age to financial issues that your, young immigrant family would typically have when it comes to saving money for, for food and for rent and whatever else. I think that helped shape kind of my views. And I guess maybe my concern with being more frugal and saving enough for future.
That's actually really interesting that you say that. I feel like it goes two extremes, right? Like, if you grew up without money and then all of a sudden, let's just say you get like an 80K, like a good, like middle income job. And now you've got like paychecks coming in the thousands every like other week or so. You're more likely, I think, to like splurge and like really treat yourself and like, go out and buy all that stuff that you can never afford. Right. So that's one potential outcome from it. But the other side is exactly what you're saying, where like you're more frugal and you're trying to avoid like being in the same situation that you grew up in, right? So that's something I think it's partially a nurture versus nature kind of debate, right? That we're not going to get into right now. So
for me, frugality means kind of to avoid lifestyle inflation, because I am making quite a bit more money than I guess the average person my age. And it's super easy for me to get caught up in that race of who has the nicer things. It's called the better than theory, right? So basically, if you compare your success based on your neighbor's success, whether that be your family, friends, other social influences. So if I see you, Nish, wearing a Gucci t-shirt, and I was just like, oh shit, Nish is more successful than me, in my head, right? Because I know the value of that t-shirt. So I'm going to one up you. I'm going to get like a Rolex watch. and then you're going to be like, oh shit, I'm going to get an AP, right? It's one of those things that keeps me grounded, frugality. So I don't fall into the entire lifestyle inflation trap. And also, as you were mentioning that book, Early Retirement Extreme, literally the entire premise and concept of that is being frugal and being frugal enough so that you're able to retire early. When I was starting off being, I'm not even going to say frugal, I was being straight up like a cheap bastard. I was cutting off everything from, so my housing expense is pretty much minimized because I'm living at home. I started cutting down on commuting because instead of taking the GO train, I started taking the TTC. Like literally for 3 months or 4 months straight, I started taking the TTC because it's like, okay, I need to cut costs more. I stopped drinking coffee altogether and just drank coffee from the office. I started penny pinching everything. But as you were mentioning, if I just cut down on housing costs, which I think is usually 30 to 40% of people's expenses in the first place, and then auto costs, which are what, probably around another 10 to 20%. I mean, right there, you're saving almost 50% of what you would have saved otherwise if you were just to go full-blown mortgage and full-blown renting everything out and not house hacking and just buying an expensive automobile, right? But yeah, that's key. I think there's definitely a fine balance, and I was definitely treading towards the stingy bastard section of that balance.
I still don't know if Austin was joking about this one, but I think he said once that he gets like a $25 gift card or something for his date nights with his girlfriend, and that dictates if they get to go out for a date night. Like it's like it was like I don't even know what
we did that. That was during my cheap bastard mode. Yeah. When we got each other gift cards, that would be the place where we would dine together as date night. So a lot of the times it was Swish LA and shit like that, right? Like that. Don't worry, I'm not like that anymore.
Swish LA is great, man.
It's okay. Dry chicken. But Nish, thank you so much for your time. Before we end off, we actually have, I guess, a little segment that we call the Furious Three. I believe that's what it's called. I don't even know. I forgot the name. Just named it literally like right before getting on this call. So let's go with the Furious Three. And these are the same three questions that we ask all of our guests. So Mayi, do you want to kick it off with question number one?
All right, Nish. So for the first question, what would you do? And I'm curious to hear your answer from a personal finance side. So what would you do if you won $10 million today?
My answer is going to be pretty lame, but I'm going to say that I would continue to invest it in fairly passive assets, I think. That's probably what I'd end up doing. So
what is a passive asset? Like what do you define as a passive asset?
Yeah, something that doesn't take a whole lot of time or stress to manage. So dividend paying stocks. I have to look at that private lending side of things, but if that's truly passive, once I try it out, that could be another avenue as well. What else? Yeah, those would really be the two main assets I'd put that money into and not really worry about. What else would I do? So in terms of with the money itself, yeah, so those sort of things, putting in the markets, paying off the house here, I'd still probably pull a home equity line of credit and use that for more funds. To why not, right? If you're going to borrow at 3% and make, 6% and make the difference, why not? Does that make me sound greedy? I don't know if it sounds greedy, but it's just additional income, more passive income. I'd probably help my mom and sister out as well, and my dad. And what else? In terms of the way I actually would live, though, I was thinking about this a bit more, and I don't know. I don't know if anything would really change all that much, because, I spend lots of time with my kids. I probably wouldn't have a 9-to-5. So spending even more time with my kids, taking on more passion projects, more time. I'd take those 40 hours or whatever, maybe 40, 50 hours, and put it towards more passion projects, spending more time with the kids. And that's pretty much what I would do. I don't think life would change a whole lot with $10 million. As lame as that
sounds. I'd expect nothing less from you, man. The second question, where will we be seeing you 5 years from now?
So this is like an interview question. I remember preparing for this question years ago for mock interviews. And the correct answer with the mock interview was like, well, I hope to be in a place where I feel challenged. I'm recognized for my efforts. And I forget the third part of that, but yeah, well, those were like the two things you got to hit when you answer that question. So I, for me with this, in this context, I don't know. I'm assuming I'm you know, in good health. Like, we take these things for granted, but assuming, you know, good health, on track financially, I hope to be in a place where I'm doing, and as cliche as it sounds, like, stuff I'm interested in, just healthy. Healthy is super, super important. You take it for granted.
Last question is, if you were to have dinner with anyone dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Yeah, I mean, I had a real struggle with this one because, you know, there's lots of celebrities that'd be cool to talk to, but I really couldn't really narrow it down. I never got a chance to meet my grandfather on my mom's side. And I think he'd be a cool guy to meet because he had 9 daughters. He lived through a civil war. He was disabled. He had to get his kids out of a war zone. And he managed to do that. Yeah. And he lived, you know, a simple life, but cool dude. I would have liked to meet him. So no specific celebrity. Some celebrities, I don't know, that's probably good.
Awesome. All right, Nish, that was a great episode. We have definitely gone well over our 40-minute target, so I'm going to have fun cutting this down. but yeah, a lot of good golden nuggets. I don't think we've actually brought it up before in the episode. So in case if you're still listening, go subscribe to Nish at Nish of All Trades. He's got a pretty awesome YouTube channel on the personal finance side. A lot of knowledge there. And yeah, so Nish, we definitely appreciate you taking the time and look forward to talking to you again, man.